Hello, my name is Marshall Rosenberg. Very glad to have this opportunity to share with you in this program some skills and some consciousness that have been extraordinarily helpful to me in my life, and I'm pleased to say that thousands of people around the world that I've shared it with find it helpful to them. So I'm glad to share it with you through this program. In this session, I'll be giving you an introduction to how I came about the process I'll be talking about, and I'll be sharing with you its purpose and give you an outline of it. The process I call nonviolent communication. I don't like that title, but why do I use it? Well, I use it because over the years it connects me with the people around the world that find our training very valuable in their lives and in their political activities. And so I have used it because it connects me with those people. But why I don't like the title, one of the reasons is the same reason that Gandhi didn't like the word nonviolent. It says what something isn't, but nonviolent communication is all focused on what we do want, not just what we don't want. Also, communication is only a small part of what I'll be sharing with you. Nonviolent communication consists of a value system that we are trying to live by, and then it outlines a language, thinking, communication skills, and means of influence that support that way of living. What I'd like to do now is give you an idea of how this process evolved. I would trace its onset to my family moving to Detroit in 1943, just in time for the race riots. My family moved into the center of where these race riots took place. This was quite an experience for me as a young boy at the time. It was an experience to sit in a house locked in for 4 days, not able to go out because of the violence in the streets, and to find out later that 30 people were killed in our neighborhood in just about a week. This stayed with me, that this is a world where people might want to hurt you because of your skin color. And when I went to school for the first time in Detroit, Michigan, I learned something else that was rather frightening to me as a young boy. I learned that my last name could be a stimulus for violence. The first day I was in class when the teacher read off the roll and said, "Marshall Rosenberg," and I raised my hand, two boys in front of me spun around and one of them said, "Are you a kike?" I had never heard that word until then, and I said, "What?" He said, "Are you a Jew?" And I said, "Yes." And he and his friend were waiting for me after I left school that day, waiting to beat me. So this was another lesson, that not only is this a world where people might want to harm you because of your skin color, but some people, hearing my name, wanted to hurt me. This instilled in me questions about, why is this? Why do people want to hurt one another? Simply because of their name, simply because of their skin color. At the same time, I had another powerful learning experience, quite a different one than to see the violence that was going on in the streets. I saw that violence isn't what we human beings are really about. I was fortunate enough to see people exercising compassion under difficult conditions. For example, my grandmother, with whom we lived, was paralyzed, and my mother was taking care of her. And each night, one of my uncles would come to help my mother take care of my grandmother, and I couldn't wait for him to get there. And I would watch as he took care of my grandmother, as he cleaned her up, gave her various medical treatments that she needed. What struck me is the whole time he was doing this, the beautiful smile on his face. Even though to me as a boy, it seemed that the work he was doing was not easy and it was difficult to clean up somebody and give them medications. The whole time he was doing it, he had such a beautiful smile on his face. So I saw this aspect of human beings who could enjoy contributing to other people's well-being. So two questions were in me from this time on and to this day. And these two questions are, what happens to people to lead them to enjoy other people's suffering and to make them want to contribute to other people's suffering? And then what happens to us human beings so that we stay with the process of compassion where we enjoy contributing to each other's well-being? I wanted to learn about that. I wanted to learn what contributes to the violence so I could do whatever I could to transform it, to prevent it. And I wanted to learn whatever I could about what helps human beings to stay connected to what I believe is our nature, our compassionate nature. And I wanted to do whatever I could to live that way myself and to distribute what I learned to others. When it came time to decide what I wanted to do in this world, I decided that I would go into psychology and study psychology. Why did I pick that? I thought that that subject would help me with those two questions of what contributes to people being violent and what kind of learning helps people to stay connected to their compassionate nature. So I went to the university with the idea of becoming a clinical psychologist. My thinking was then that people who are acting violent must have some kind of mental dysfunction, some kind of illness. So I would learn how to cure this illness. In the course of getting my doctor's degree in psychology, I had a good experience with a professor of mine, Professor Michael Hakim, and he helped me to see that the choice I had made, clinical psychology, had some limits to it. First of all, he showed me that the way that psychologists and psychiatrists diagnose people didn't have any scientific research to document that these words that they use could be scientifically diagnosed. And he also showed me that by looking at the problem of why are people violent as an illness, that it overlooks how the structures of our society contribute to people behaving in this way. And he helped me to see that by diagnosing people as mentally ill and believing that the violence was a cause of mental illness, that we were then taking the focus away from the education that the structures provided, which create the violence. I learned that after I had already gone just about to the point of graduation with a doctor's degree. So it was quite upsetting having spent about 8 years at the university, learning this profession, and then just as I was about to graduate, finding out from this professor the limitations of that. So when I graduated, I decided to go into private practice and try to help people transform their violence. But I found that the tools that I had learned to do this with, the tools of psychoanalytic therapy and other psychological trainings which were in current at the time, the first thing I found, it didn't work very well, in the sense that it took a long time and I didn't really see any major transformations occurring in the people. Yes, they seemed to like coming in and have somebody listen to them, but I wasn't really seeing any major changes occurring in their lives. So I decided to start off with a couple of questions different than I had been encouraged to ask myself in the course of my training in psychology. instead of diagnosing what it was in people that's wrong with them that makes them violent and trying to cure that, I decided to start with a different question. How were we meant to live? Now, where do you find out this information? Well, for about a year, I studied comparative religions, believing that the religions were each trying to define this question, how were we meant to live, and to let us know this. So, through readings and taking some courses, I came to a conclusion after reading about comparative religions that they all were saying pretty much the same thing, that compassion is how we were meant to live, contributing to one another's well-being willingly, out of the joy that comes naturally when we exercise our power in the service of contributing to people's well-being. They each said this perhaps in a different way, but I got this same message that our nature as human beings is to exercise our enormous power in the service of life, to enrich life in ourselves and others. Realizing this and seeing that this was the core message in all of the religions that I studied, an obvious question came to me. If we seem to all agree on this subject, that compassionate giving is what we human beings are meant to be, I wondered why we're not doing it. And then I started to ask myself the question, what skills are necessary to live compassionately? And then I saw that the skills that seemed to be necessary to live compassionately were quite different than the skills that we were taught. And then when I asked myself, why is that? Then the professor that I mentioned's words came to me, that we were educated to contribute to the structures we were living in. And these structures are structures in which people claim to be superiors and know what's right for others, and to impose what they believe is right on the others. And that way of living requires a certain way of thinking, communicating, and using power. And I saw that that was the problem, that what created violence was a certain way of thinking, a certain language, and a certain way of using power. But then I asked myself, well, what are the skills that are necessary to live in harmony with compassionate giving? What kind of language is necessary? What kind of communication skills are necessary? What kind of thinking supports it? And what kinds of means of influence support it? And where do you find that information? Because it wasn't too clear as I was reading about the comparative religions how specifically we were meant to behave in order to live in harmony with compassionate giving. So what I decided to do was then do a different kind of research, to observe the people that I respected the most, who seemed the most compassionate, who seemed to enjoy giving to others. And I tried to see how were they different than the people who seemed to enjoy criticizing, blaming, attacking others. And it was through studying these people, also studying some research in psychology that tried to identify what characteristics of development contribute to people's behaving in a compassionate way, I put together from these sources a process that seemed to me to summarize how we were meant to live and the skills that were necessary to do this. And that's how nonviolent communication evolved, from the research that I did to identify what kind of human development is necessary for us to live compassionately. So the process that I call nonviolent communication consists of an intention to contribute to our own well-being and the well-being of others compassionately. And what I mean by giving compassionately is, first of all, that whatever we do is done willingly. It's not done out of guilt or shame or fear of punishment or trying to buy love by submitting to what we think others expect us to do. No, I saw that the intention I wanted to live by and that I thought was necessary for compassionate giving was that we give solely out of the joy that comes naturally from contributing to life, our own life and the lives of others. And I organized what I was learning about this into the program that I now call Nonviolent Communication. And at the time, I was in private practice of psychology. So in my private practice, people were coming to me because of depression. Children were sent to me because they were having problems in school. And couples were coming to me because of marital problems. And I found that this process that I was putting together was much more effective as a healing tool for people than the way I had been taught to do psychotherapy at the university. And at first I was shocked by this because it was so different than how I had been trained to analyze people and provide psychotherapy. It seemed too simple to just show them how some different ways of behaving, different ways of thinking, communicating, using power, how quickly this could correct problems that were taking me months and not getting the same result. But then when I really saw the power that the program had, I also saw that the way I was offering it to people was not the way that I saw when I wanted to continue, because by offering it in a private practice as a psychologist, the people who were coming to me were defining that there was something wrong with them, something mentally ill about them, for which they needed healing. And I was seeing more and more how that very concept of mental illness was a destructive concept because it implied something was wrong with people that needed fixing. And that very concept, as I'll talk about in subsequent sessions, I see gets in the way of people's evolution and human development.